You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, taking you around the National League East, and there's never a dull moment in Gotham. The New York Mets get a great start from Matt Harvey, something much needed. Let's start with the Mets and our MLB.com Mets reporter, Anthony DiComo. Anthony, the words everybody, or every Met fan, I think, has been waiting to hear at some point is Matt Harvey is back, and we at least got a taste of that on Monday. He certainly looked good. Seven innings, two hits, seven scoreless innings. He struck out six, and he only walked one. And the great effort comes after a mechanical tweak. How much of his performance on Monday can we put on that change in his mechanics?
You know, I don't know. I think the mechanics aspect of it is a little overblown. And not to say there's not something to that. Certainly there is, but that's not the only reason why Matt Harvey struggled. I think there was definitely a big mental aspect to it. I think there might have even been a fatigue, a dead arm aspect to it. We've seen him and pretty much every pitcher go through that sort of thing in the past. So that's why I think this was so hard for Matt Harvey to correct, if he has indeed corrected it. And just because it's more than one thing. I do think the mechanics helped. I think he understands that part of it and obviously knew what he was doing wrong. But it's going to be more than just that. He needs to mentally continue to wrap his head around what he needs to do. And frankly, he said it best himself, I thought. This is one start, and it means nothing if I don't continue to go out there and do it. So for me, I'll be looking out there 5 days later. I'll be looking out 5 days after that. And if he can string two, three, four, a month and a half, 2 months worth of good starts, then all of a sudden you're looking at, hey, Matt Harvey is indeed back and back to where the Mets knew he could be.
Yeah, it certainly needs to become the norm and not the exception. I think one thing that is at least encouraging, other than, you know, whatever you can take from the mechanical change, is that his fastball velocity seemed to be back where it was a year ago. And it seems like if he has that, it kind of makes every pitch better, right? The changeup's a little better and everything's a little better if his fastball is popping.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was a huge part of what was dogging him a little bit. And, you know, people around the team love to downplay velocity and say it really doesn't matter. And that's true to a certain extent. But when you're used to pitching your whole life at 95, 96, and you're able to reach back for 98 when you need it, and then all of a sudden you're down to 92, 93, and the most you can reach back for is like a 95, it makes a difference. But when you're not used to that and you're not used to pitching in that way, not that there's anything wrong with 93. That's plenty good enough to succeed in the big leagues. But I think it was a little bit of an adjustment period for Matt Harvey for not having that really good fastball that we have come to know from him. And, how he got it back, again, I think it was partially mechanics. I think it was partially the fact that his arm was probably a little tired. And now that we're getting into midsummer and it's hot every day, you know, I'm walking around this morning and sweating because it's up in the 80s every day. I think that plays a role. It all plays a role. And I think that would certainly be, if that did play into it, a good news for Matt Harvey to keep this going, because it's not going to cool off anytime soon.
Bill, you look at this Nationals team, and boy, Daniel Murphy has kind of put this team on his back and carried them, especially with Bryce Harper not having as good a May as he did in April and being banged up right now. But when you look at Murphy after Tuesday night, he goes 2-for-4, hits yet another homer. The average up to 397, which is basically at this point in the season historically good. 47 hits in the month of May, which ties a Nats/Expos record. I mean, I know the Nationals had high expectations for what this guy could do when they signed him in the offseason, but he has to be blowing away even the highest expectations.
He is. I got to tell you, I think it goes back to the postseason. He was so hot there, it's carried over to now, and it's unbelievable to watch him play. So it's been great.
What stands out the most to you? I mean, he's obviously doing it with the power that we saw in the postseason last year, and that's something that's come on later in his career. But to hit for the power and for the average, I mean, what strikes you the most, or what impresses you the most about his approach at the plate?
He uses the whole field. he goes the other way, goes to left field, goes all over the place. And I think, that's what has impressed me the most. And I got to tell you, watching him play, I just never expected him to be this good. I mean, we expected average defense, which he has done. And offensively, he's just been doing the job, driving in runs, hitting home runs. I mean, he's gone beyond, I think the Nationals, what the Nationals expected.
Yeah, and the defense is obviously the one thing that people have always kind of questioned, and he struggled with at times. When he hits the way he's hit, you can kind of look the other way a little bit on the defense, but the defense has been okay, certainly, and not a real negative for him. It's been quite a start to the season in his Nationals career. All right, I mentioned Bryce Harper banged up now. He gets hit in the knee. He was out of the lineup on Tuesday. Bill, it seems like there's not going to be any situation here as far as a disabled list, but when do you expect Harper to be able to get back in the lineup?
Hopefully by the next series. He'll be okay. I mean, he's still sore now, and like Dusty said, it's day-to-day, so we have to see what happens.
Joe Ross pitched on Tuesday night, and he's almost exactly right now to the one-year anniversary of his Major League debut. That was June 6th of 2015, and it seems like he's just kind of gotten better and better since getting called up by the Nationals. On Tuesday night, 7 innings, 3 hits, 1 earned run. He walked a couple of guys. He struck out 5, obviously against a Phillies lineup that's offensively challenged, to say the least. But overall, Ross lowers his ERA to 2.37, and he has been just – I mean, when you look at this rotation, obviously you have the guys that really stand out at the top with Scherzer and Strasburg, but Ross is right there and just a little bit behind those guys.
This is what Dusty Baker expected. He expected Joe Ross to be this good. I mean, as you see, he's giving him the chance to go deep in games. He did it last week. He did it again this week. I mean, I think he's expecting Joe Ross to go at least 7 innings almost every start. So I think if you talk to Dusty Baker, he's not surprised by what he's doing.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Phillies reporter Todd Zalecki. And Todd, I think we kind of knew at some point things were going to probably swing the other way as far as luck and the odds of baseball. But the Phillies right now heading into Wednesday action, they've lost 5 in a row, 9 of 11. Seems like things are just kind of catching up with them, in danger of a second straight sweep. Has there been a difference on the field other than, they're not winning one-run games and the run differential is kind of just catching up with them?
Yeah, I really think it's just kind of the law of averages is finally tilting away from the Phillies' favor. They have not been getting outstanding starting pitching in this stretch, and that's kind of what helped them to that hot start and allow them to win a lot of those one-run games. So you combine the fact that the offense remains one of the worst offenses in baseball and the fact that the starting pitching has not been as sharp, it kind of explains why they are where they are. They're just not going to be able to, if the starting rotation or the pitching staff gives up 4 or 5 runs, you can pretty much pencil in as the Phillies have lost. They're just not able to overcome that type of deficit.
And you mentioned the struggling offense, and that brings us right to kind of, to a degree, breaking news, I guess, as we record this podcast, and that is Coach Mackinnon coming out and saying that Ryan Howard will be benched the next 3 to 4 games. I guess that's not a set amount of time, but Tommy Joseph will be getting the starts for a decent little stretch here, and I guess you got a chance to talk to Ryan Howard a little bit. How is he taking that news?
Actually, he took it pretty well. Pete said to us earlier, before we talked to Ryan, that his discussion, he called it a great discussion. He said Howard obviously wasn't happy with the news, but he understood it. He understands where he's at, and quite frankly, Howard really handled himself well, talking about his situation. He knows that he had a really awful May. He knows what his numbers are. He knows that the team is trying to win and look at younger players, and he knows that Tommy Joseph, since he's been called up, has been pretty productive. So you combine all of those things, and he kind of sees the writing on the wall. It's not like he's in the second year of a 6-year contract, a year or two removed from an MVP season, and he's going, what the heck are you guys doing to me? He's in the final year of his contract. His numbers have been steadily decreasing over the past few years, and like I said, his May was pretty bad. He's hitting around 150 or so, and Tommy Joseph has been playing well. So he didn't really have much of an argument to make. And, you know, to his credit, he says, hey, I want to win, and I'm going to work hard to get back. I'm not going to sit here and just relinquish my role. I hope to get it back, and that's my intention.
Yeah, and I guess the one thing he has supplied this year, you mentioned the average 154 heading into Wednesday, the OPS 558, but he has 8 home runs, 19 RBI. So he's had a little bit of a power. I wonder, as we get later in the season, if he's able to get in the lineup here and there and continue to show that pop. Is there any possibility, Todd, that you could see come trade deadline that the Phillies would be able to trade him for something, get something back for Ryan Howard to a team that maybe needs that bat off the bench down the stretch?
Boy, they've tried really hard over the past couple of years to trade Howard and have found nobody interested at all. So I think if Howard is moved at the trade deadline, you know, certainly, actually, you could probably push it to August because of his contract.
Yeah.
You know, he would clear waivers. So they would really have until August 31st to move him. I think if they do move him, it would essentially be just a salary dump. Kind of, you know what, hey, it's not working out here. You're not playing. We can put you in a situation where you might have a chance to go to the postseason, and we'll just let you go. And the Phillies, I assume, would pick up almost all of that remaining salary. But other than that, no, I think it'll be tough. It'll be real tough to move him.
Yeah, I guess my thought was maybe with not much time left in the contract, maybe a team would be taking on the prorate. But you're right. It would certainly be tough, and you said it. They have certainly tried. The Phillies did also make another move today. They add Jimmy Paredes. They get him from the Blue Jays, who had gotten him not so long ago off of waivers from the Orioles. He's just one of those guys this season that it seems that's kind of – just moving around on the carousel, but he's a guy that at times can be a productive player. The defense isn't great, but he can bring a little bit with the bat at times. What do the Phillies hope to get out of Paredes?
You know, I don't think they expect too much, but certainly they expect a little bit better offense from him than they were getting from Emmanuel Burris, who they designated for assignment today. And Pete McCannon actually spoke pretty highly of him, saying that, you know, he could be one of the – he's actually a better hitter than some of the guys on the team. So I think they're just looking at him. He can play second. He can play a little bit of third. He can play some outfield. Just have him kind of move around a little bit and maybe give them a little bit more than what they were getting from Emmanuel Burris. Because while they loved Emmanuel Burris in the clubhouse, he was positive. Teammates really loved him. He was a good guy to be around. You know, he just was not able to come up with a hit in the pinch hitting situation or come up with a hit on those rare opportunities when he had the chance to start. So just a little bit more production, I think, is all they're looking for.
Joe, a tough one to take on Monday night, but maybe one of those games that you just kind of throw it out the window, a 10-0 loss to the Pirates. And I think maybe the biggest surprise in this 10-0 loss was who was on the mound for the other team, because Jeff Locke, you don't think of him as a dominating type starter who's going to go out and throw a complete game. In fact, he had never done that, but he does it against the Marlins on Monday night. One strikeout, which is more what you think of with Jeff Locke, but what was it from the Marlins' perspective that made him so tough to hit on Monday?
Yeah, Tim, that was one of the weird ones. And, you know, writing that game story, I think it was the first time a Pirates had a complete game since 2014. And like you say, he faced the minimum up until Jeff Mathis got a two-out hit in the ninth inning. Otherwise, he would have faced 27 batters. He was helped, obviously, by two double plays. The game started, Echevarria leads off, gets a single. Then Prado grounds into a double play. And that kind of, they already down, Marlins are already down a run. Then when I think the Pirates got that second run, it was still a manageable game from Miami standpoint, but the big five-run sixth inning really demoralized the Marlins, and Locke's pitch count was very, very low, and he was just able to just kind of cruise the rest of the way, changing things up. But, Tim, I think a bigger issue is, you know, for the Marlins, they're getting pretty depleted with their position players. They're a little shorthanded. Obviously, Stanton's not back. Yelich is only back for the second or so start. And, you know, Derek Dietrich got the hit in the head and put the foul ball in Atlanta, and he didn't start. And Miguel Rojas is filling, you know, he gets a shoulder injury. So, you know, they're kind of scrapping this to kind of hold a lineup together. And on top of that, they're facing a very good defensive team. And, you know, let's make no mistake about it yesterday, too, with Locke early on. There was one thing, I can't remember which one, but the Marlins stung three balls in a row. Chris Johnson hit 110 miles an hour, according to StatCast, on exit velo that was snared at third base. So he also got with the beneficiary of, you know, some good defense and some atom balls, as they call them, you know, balls hit at those guys.
Now, when you turn the page to Tuesday, a little bit different as far as the pitching goes. Jose Fernandez will be on the hill for the Marlins, and then it's Gerrit Cole. At this point, when you look at what the Marlins did on Monday, are they almost better off facing a little more velocity in a guy like Cole?
Well, oddly, you know, it's an interesting point. They have handled some of the best pitchers in the league this year and beaten them. They've beaten Scherzer. They've beaten Kershaw, among others. They won a game that Syndergaard pitched in New York, although Syndergaard didn't get the loss that day. I'm not sure it's ever an easier day at the office, but it does seem that those guys that, you know, could prey on the Marlins' over-aggressiveness, which they tend to do, those are the pitchers that have a lot more success, it seems like, against the Marlins than necessarily, you know, the hard throwers.
You mentioned the injuries along the infield and the team in general, and obviously the suspension to D. Gordon doesn't help things at all either. They're already, in a sense, shorthanded. But things could have been worse, I guess, in the fact that Derek Dietrich kind of lucks out in a bit. I mean, it's a scary moment, the foul ball off the bat of Yelich, and it hits Dietrich in the head. He seemed to, you know, the next day he's out there and he's kind of got the construction helmet on for BP. Seemed to take it in stride and kind of have a really good attitude about the whole thing. And luckily, it wasn't more serious than it could have been.
Yeah, you know, obviously the initial concern is make sure he's okay. And, you know, he spent the night in Atlanta for observation. He was discharged from the hospital. You know, I can't tell you exact hour, but, you know, at some point there, and spent the night in the hotel. After that, he was cleared of all concussion-like symptoms or potential fracture. And once he was good to go, he was back in Miami. It's a short flight back from Atlanta to Miami. And, you know, the players had some fun with him while he is stretching. One of the players brought out the hard hat. They already customized it with the 32, and they made him kind of wear it the whole batting practice.
Mark, the Braves, they took 2 of 3 from the Marlins over the weekend, and coming into Thursday as we record this while the team is actually on the field, they had a chance to take 3 of 4 from the first-place Giants from out west. Looks like that's going to kind of go the other way, and it's going to end up being a series split. But nonetheless, not a terrible stretch for the Braves. Aaron Blair has been back up from his minor league stint here for a little bit, and he's on the mound against the Giants on Thursday, and he looked real good through 4, but you got to throw strikes. You can't put guys on base. That's exactly what happened in a tough 5th for him, where he walks a batter, gives up a home run, walks a batter, gives up another home run. The Giants are the type of team that tends to make you pay for those mistakes.
Yeah, you know, you look at Aaron Blair, and even when he had some success, and when I say success, his line scores were, respectable. They're the first few starts. You questioned where his potential is, you know, where his upside is. And that goes back to the trade. When the Braves made the trade, when they traded Shelby Miller to the Diamondbacks to get Blair, Enciarte, and Dansby Swanson, Blair was basically described as a major league ready pitcher who could be a solid number 3 or number 4. He does not have the upside as some of these other guys that are in the system. You know, even as you watched Mike Foltynewicz struggle last year, you knew that he had the potential that he's shown this month. You don't see Aaron Blair reaching that level. You know, right now, what it all comes down to fastball command. It has been very inconsistent. These last few starts, he had a decent one when he came back up against the Marlins last weekend. But at the same time, you have to question whether or not he's needed more time at the minor league level. Maybe even go back to April when he was brought up. Was he rushed at that point in time? They certainly brought him back earlier than they wanted to this time, which goes back to the game where they burned through their bullpen through the first nine innings against the Brewers and ended up having to use Casey Kelly, you know, for four innings that night, and then that prompted them to have to bring Blair back up to make a start last Saturday against the Marlins. So he's probably a kid that needs more time. I think what is interesting is, you know, he's struggling to the point that you question whether he needs to go back to the minors. You've got Lucas Sims, who's certainly not major league ready right now. His command has been off at Triple A Gwinnett. Yet the team is moving Terrell Jenkins to the bullpen at Gwinnett with the hope that maybe he can join Atlanta's pen by the end of the month. And while I do understand that Terrell Jenkins has basically been a two-pitch type of guy who's probably projects to be a reliever long-term, it's interesting that they're already making that move when they don't necessarily when they might need Terrell to fill some starts while Blair goes back to the minors to develop and while Sims takes his time to go through his development as well. So it's peculiar timing, to say the least, with this decision with Jenkins.
Yeah, and it certainly is, and it's just an odd time, it feels like, for this franchise, because it just seems like nothing's – obviously they've made all the moves to get younger, but nothing's quite there yet, and you see it kind of everywhere with the lack of runs and then so many questions and so many moving parts as far as the pitching goes as well. Julio Teheran has pitched very well himself, despite – not having a lot to show for it, Mark. In May, a .80 ERA in five May starts. That was before Sunday. Overall, he's 1-5. He seems like he's the Shelby Miller of this year. Last year, Shelby Miller had so many solid starts and yet didn't have the record. And it seems like this year, Tehran's that guy. Is he frustrated at all?
It is very encouraging to see how well Julio Teheran has pitched lately. You could call him this year's Shelby Miller or Matt Whistler this year's Shelby Miller in terms of lack of run support. That's going to go across the board. All the starting pitchers are going to deal with some of this offense's limited capability throughout the season. But like I said, it's encouraging to see Julio pitching better right now. I think he's gotten to the point to where you say, hey, look, this guy could be a solid number two or number three and a rotation for many years to come. If you look at the stuff that Mike Foltynewicz has, that's the difference between being an ace. Julio Teheran is not that kind of guy, but at the same time, his 92-93 does play up just from the fact that he's now spotting his changeup. He's throwing that fastball for strikes, locating it. He's getting some swings and misses that give you the sense that he could at least be that veteran anchor in this rotation. As they continue to go through some of the growing pains with some of these young pitchers that they'll continue to add to the rotation over the next couple of years. Their entire rotation is 25 years young right now. It's you're not going to get a lot of consistency, but I think it was when they look back on May, the month of May, and watch the growth that Mike Foltynewicz had, the consistency that Matt Whistler showed, and the turnaround that Julio Teheran continued to complete, that this could be a very important month moving forward. When you look back, you say, hey, look, that's kind of when things started to turn around, at least in the starting pitching department for this organization.